This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm here with Susan. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rabia.
How you doing?
Just peachy keen, you know?
Are you self-quarantined?
I am de facto self-quarantined.
As podcasters, I think we are often self-quarantined.
Like, is it really a change?
No.
Maybe not.
The only real difference right now is that, like, my husband was told yesterday that all employees go home and work from home for the rest of the month. So he's here. My nanny is here today with my son, and my mother and my aunt are visiting. So there's a lot of us at home right now, which is great. It's just great.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I called my parents a couple days ago, and they're like, "Hey, can't hear you at a bar." I'm like, "Mom, Dad.
Oh no,
what are y'all doing?"
What are they doing? Are they
at
not believing it?
They're playing trivia at a bar, apparently oblivious to the worldwide pandemic.
Did you change their minds about...
I did not. Okay. I did not. I tried.
You know, I'm still a little confused. We talked about this last week about where to fall on the panic scale, but we'll talk about that in a second, so we'll get to... Or should we just go
let's
ahead
go
and...
right into
let's
it.
Let's just go so right
just,
into
we
it.
We just had, about an hour ago now, the WHO, World Health Organization, mm-hmm. announced that it is officially a pandemic, as if you hadn't noticed yet.
What is the difference here? There's between an epidemic and a pandemic.
Pandemic is worldwide, or close enough to worldwide. Epidemic is just more localized or half the world. So it's not, at this point, it's kind of irrelevant because it was obviously a pandemic, so whoop-de-doo. But yeah, we are in a pandemic. The announcement makes it official. And yeah, buckle up, folks.
Yeah. So... I know one of the big issues we've been seeing over and over again in the media, and we raised this last week too, is the issue around testing. And I mean, like, oh, yeah, there's not a day that goes by you don't see more stories online about people who are like, I've got symptoms, I qualify in XYZ ways, I've been traveling, I've been exposed to somebody, I can't get tested. So can you update us on what's happening with the testing front?
Testing front is still not looking acceptable. We know a little more now about what happened over the past couple months, but the end result is that we are not in a position as a nation to do testing on the scale that is necessary to remotely dampen the spread. We've had a lot of weaselly, confusing statements from various people in the administration. There's never been a firm answer given, but for the most part, the past few days, especially watching the CDC director and his various interviews and appearances before Congress, his whole goal right now is to focus on how this is all not his fault. Mm. Because the CDC is...
Did he give a statement today or something? What happened?
On the Hill, there was a hearing for
okay.
the House Oversight, and Dr. Fauci and HHS guy, a few others, and also Redford, the CDC director, were there. And let's to broaden the picture here. So the testing issues, what we know so far is basically this. In January, the CDC began working on developing a COVID-19 test. This happened right after China, like, sequenced the genome of the virus, and all the countries, you know, got to work on that. And there's sort of two different parallel storylines here. The first is the story of the CDC. So the CDC's test was made pretty quickly, and on February 4th, the HHS, Secretary Azar, issued a regulation, basically, that says, okay, this new CDC test for COVID-19 gets an emergency use authorization. It's not been tested, it's not been gone through the usual FDA process, but because there's, you know, kind of emergency going on, we're going to go ahead and allow the CDC's COVID-19 test to be used. So CDC gets to work on putting it out there, and within like less than 10 days, but by the 12th, it's very clear that something has gone wrong. Still not sure what, or they're not explaining exactly what it was. Either one of the reagents was wrong, or there's contamination at the lab. Either way, the test had faulty controls, so labs were getting results they couldn't trust, because even though it sounds like the actual COVID-19 part was accurate and working, the test that says whether it worked right or not was broken. So the test would be a negative, or the test would say, like, test didn't work at all, even when it did. So that delays the CDC's test development and getting it out to the world. And by, like, February 20, like, 1st or 5th, they had, like, six labs in the whole U.S. that could do it. And at that point, the testing was like under 400 people. The whole point was, if you've been to China, not even like Italy or anywhere else, if you've been to like Wuhan, China, and you have symptoms, then you can get the test. Or if you've been like on one of the cruises, you get the test. And that was obviously insufficient. Then we had, you know, kind of this massive discovery that, by the way, it's everywhere, which was only discovered because the Seattle flu study was technically breaking the rules.
Right. So this story broke like yesterday, I think, and it was all over social media. New York Times story about a scientist or a doctor who was like suspicious. And what did this happen in December or January? Or was it January? It was a while ago. And she's like, I'm just going to kind of test folks on my own.
Yes, they decided as part of their work, which is normally monitoring the flu and like flu strains, they would also, you know, do some sentinel testing, see if anything popped up out there on the COVID-19 front.
But here's my question, Susan. How, one thing I didn't quite get clear is how, if they don't have a specific COVID-19 test, can they test for it?
They do have it. They did have one.
They don't. Okay.
They just weren't authorized to use it.
Ooh, I see.
in that manner. It was kind of a gray area. It was not like, I mean, it was, they made a call. They tried to get permission to do it the right way. They couldn't get it. They went ahead and did it. And that's how this random kid in Seattle who had flu symptoms and nothing severe was found. Like, oh God, this random kid has it. Who else has it? Turns out like lots and lots of people. So that's problematic. What we know from the CDC, like the fact that they restricted use to such a small subset is problematic. The fact the test didn't work right away. I mean, yeah, that's not great, but you know, sometimes things happen that you can't control, and I'm willing to chalk that up to this. The bigger issue is this. It doesn't matter what the CDC was doing, because none of that was ever going to be enough or even remotely sufficient to address the problem of a COVID-19 outbreak in the United States. At no point did the CDC ever consider making testing available on a widespread scale. At all times, their focus was on public health testing, which is like, you know, people being brought in from overseas, from infected areas, and like the, you know, quarantine ships they run in to repatriate people. That was their focus. They had no focus on actually testing people's symptoms or actually diagnosing it in the field. That was not their focus or concern. They didn't do anything about that. They did not see it as their job. According to Redmond, the director, he just says over and over again, oh, like he actually said, like, you know, I anticipated the private sector would come together and address this like shortfall. So CDC's point of view all along is that it was never a job in the first place to have widespread testing. Now, the other part of this is the FDA. And the FDA is responsible for, you know, allowing or not allowing tests to happen. And it was not until February 29th, like after we knew that from the like Seattle flu study that there was, you know, community spread going on, that they'd signed another order. And this time, for the first time ever, people could potentially use tests that weren't from the CDC. So suddenly they unleashed everything. People could, right away, if they had the ability, start developing and using their own test. And within 15 days, they could get sort of after-the-fact permission. So like emergency permission, whatever. The point being, until February 29th, no one in the U.S. government was considering how or if or can we make tests that would be sufficient to handle an outbreak.
But here's the thing. Okay, so now we have permission for private companies and labs. And in fact, there was a story that the Bill Gates Foundation is providing all this funding in Washington to provide testing as well. But I don't know what's happening in Washington, but from the stories, at least on the East Coast, it seems like people are still not being able, like they're just being rerouted and cannot find a where to actually get tested.
So you'll see on the news, like, you know, have Pence and the CDC and HHS, they make statements like, oh, anyone can get testing now. There's nothing standing in the way of testing from the federal government. All they're saying and all they mean is that they no longer have any prohibitions on testing. Right. Anyone that has a test and can do it can do it. But guess what? Not that many people can, because we have very few test kits available. They are ramping up production, but it's slow. And even when they finally got their stuff together and were like, well, we should really look at how to bulk produce this stuff so we can use it in a clinical setting. Apparently no one thought to look into the fact that like a testing for any kind of virus or organism using DNA requires like multiple steps. And one of those is like extracting the genetic material to examine it. And no one checked in that supply line. So we are now at another critical bottleneck of people not being able to get the materials you need just to extract genetic material to test it, see if it's COVID-19.
So when you're talking about the materials, you mean like swabs and things, like actual physical material? I know around the country, because there's like a crazy rush to buy like masks and stuff, you've got people in the medical industry that cannot just find supplies to continue their work. Is that what you're talking about?
It's kind of similar to that. In this case, it's just like the materials you use to extract the RNA from the virus. Like that material is not being produced enough on a scale that can accommodate all this testing. So now the Trump administration is like, we have a surplus of tests available, implying that like there's no shortage. Well, what they mean is that we have more test kits than we can possibly actually use, given the other limitations on the system.
Mm. Not that there's widespread testing happening, which is not happening. So I went on what is probably going to be the last trip that I take for a while, thanks to self-quarantine this past weekend. I traveled to Iowa. I hang out with a bunch of girlfriends, and I got a lot of comments because I was wearing my Rothy's, and everybody wanted to know, what the hell are those adorable shoes you're wearing?
I did too, because I was in New York with my girlfriends, and I wore two pairs of Rothy's that I'm in love with and walked everywhere and was totally comfortable.
First of all, I gotta tell you guys, Susan and I did not conspire or collaborate when we ordered our Rothy's. We just ended up getting
mind meld.
We just mind melded. We ordered almost the exact, and they have so many styles. We ordered almost exactly the same one. So check out our social media feed, because we will definitely tweet out pictures of that.
But I like that pair so much, I ended up getting another. I got the Chelsea boot in like metallic sparkly blue.
Oh my god, that sounds adorable. Okay, so you gotta tweet a picture of that too, because I want to see what that looks like. So let's tell our listeners why we love Rothy's. What are they all about?
Really comfortable, great shoes.
Yes, but they're also sustainable, and they make bags too now. They're actually made out of eco-friendly materials like repurposed plastic water bottles and marine plastic, which blows my mind because they are so flipping comfortable. I cannot tell you.
They are extremely comfortable and washable. They're comfortable and washable. Like, they're everything.
I've never owned a pair of shoes that I can put in the washing machine, but here we are.
Not ones I could wear to work.
Yeah, and you don't have to break them in. So when I got my Rothy's, it was winter, so I didn't wear them because they're flat, but like the weather was so beautiful. This is the first time I wore them. No break-in. They're just comfortable as a glove, first time around. Loved it.
Yeah, these shoes are made out of plastic bottles. Rothy's has kept 50 million single-use plastic bottles out of landfills and transformed them into their signature thread, which is then knit into beautiful, wearable, sustainable products.
It's incredible. They've got new colors and patterns every few weeks, and they sell out a lot, so you definitely have to check it out. They own and operate their own manufacturing workshop, and, you know, everything about Rothy's we love. So check out all the amazing shoes and bags actually available right now at rothys.com/45th. That's rothys.com, rothys.com/45th.
Comfort, style, and sustainability meet to create your new favorites. Head to rothys.com/45th today.
Different states have announced states of emergency. You've got New York, New Jersey, Maryland. I'm a little confused about Maryland, but it is what it is. I saw Andrew Cuomo on TV a couple days ago. He said, and a number of actually state governments have said this, they've said, ignore the federal government, listen to your local and state governments. and I think that's insane that that's like the messaging that's happening. And we talked last week a little bit about the concerns that the White House, Trump has around messaging, because for him, it's all about numbers and what looks good for him and bad for him. And apparently today, the National Security Council, White House, has ordered that all the coronavirus meetings are happening with federal officials and the different agencies, that they all be categorized as classified. So it's like turning into this big secret thing.
Yeah. So to push back a bit on that, there, it's not entirely clear what that Reuters story was about regarding the interagency meetings that were apparently held in mm-hmm. their controlled room, the SCIF. So the reporting is like, it's classified, but it's not clear if it's actually classified, or if they were using like the SCIF rooms to have these interagency meetings. And I did see some people from other administrations noting that didn't seem abnormal to them, and that often for these kind of like events, they would use the secured communications format, not to try and hide anything, but that was the best way to communicate conveniently and securely for different agencies.
I guess given the fact that a week ago they had a press conference, which they're like, no audio and videos allowed.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
This is all... Okay, yeah. So not to be alarmist, but like at this point, I think there's a case to be made that panic would be a beneficial response. Not that panic is necessary, but to counteract the complacency, we need more people being panicked. Because we're so far behind the ball that the time for like, be alert and concerned, but don't panic, that kind of messaging, you know, that horse has left the barn.
I mean, what's interesting is you do have like a number of Republican congressmen who have self-quarantined, including Matt Gaetz.
Oh my God.
They've self-quarantined. So I would say they're sending the right message. That is a responsible thing to do, but
not all of them. Gohmert didn't.
Right. But at the same time, there was a number of threads circulating on Twitter the other day that said, okay, do you have like relatives or friends who are basically treating this like as a hoax? And we're seeing this. There was like this whole segment on Fox the other night where Trish something, I don't know what her last name is, but she said this is all this panic is being manipulated by the Democrats to bring down President Trump. Not that the virus itself is a hoax, but like the concern around the virus, like these extreme measures like self-quarantine. So there are people who are like, screw it, I'm still going on cruises. I don't believe it. It's bullshit. I mean, there's so many stories. So you have a big segment of the country that refuses to take the precautions that are necessary to protect really themselves and their loved ones here.
The messaging has been a failure because there is... Given the severity of the threat, there has not been communications that express that in a way that the public can understand and digest over time. Trump's insistence over and over again that it's all fine, it's going to go down, everything's good, it's going to disappear, has made people reasonably complacent because, like, if there was something that's going to, you know, disrupt our entire way of life, surely someone would be a little more vocal about it. And no one was. So it's going to take time, even after things get pretty bad places in the country, it's going to take a while to overcome that inertia and to have a universal recognition in the U.S. that this is not a drill. There's going to have to be stuff done. If we don't want millions of people to die, you don't have to die.
I want to play a couple clips of what Boris Johnson's been saying across...
Oh, I don't even know. I'm scared.
Oh, Susan. Let's just take a listen.
Victoria, I can tell you that I'm shaking hands. I was at a hospital the other night where I think there were actually a few coronavirus patients, and I shook hands with everybody. You'll be pleased to know, and I continue to shake hands. And I think it's very important that we, you know, people obviously can make up their own minds. I think that Matt has said that people must make up their own minds, but I think the scientific evidence is, well, I'll hand over to the experts, but our judgment is wash. Washing your hands is the crucial thing.
You know, perhaps you could sort of take it on the chin, take it all in one go, and allow the disease, as it were, to move through the population. I think we need to strike a balance.
There's actually two different clips of him. In both the clips, he's just like, you want to shake hands? Shake hands. It's okay to shake hands. Another one's in the other clip, the first clip, which is the most alarming clip, he said, listen, some people are saying the best option here is to just kind of like rush into it head first, everybody get coronavirus.
No.
Yes, he is saying everybody get coronavirus so that it just kind of comes and goes and we just, it's like this wave you're just going to ride. Oh, people are going to die. I literally read a piece that said, look, okay, it's going to maybe cull the elderly. They use the word cull. Cull. Yeah, I'm not even kidding. So there's some terrible messaging going on out there. But I will say this. So what do we tell our listeners? I mean, I think what you tell your listeners, I think the way I feel about this is it's best just to stay home as much as you can, to self-quarantine as much as you can. I don't think you need enormous amounts of toilet paper. I think if you can get through like the next 2 to 4 weeks, you should be okay. But what do you think this wave is going to look like? I mean, a month, 2 months, 3 months?
I guess it's important. Might as well remember, this is not going to be like the end of civilization. This is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a whole lot of people dying who never needed to die if there was a proper government response.
Yeah.
And a lot of chaos in the meantime. And sure, some events are going to get missed, whatever, at this point. So I don't want to make it think like it's not the end of the world. It is not the end of the world. But this needs to be... people need to take it seriously and figure out a plan if they have relatives who are at higher risk.
Counterpoint to it's not the end of the world. Apparently, North Korea launched an unidentified object a couple days ago.
Not now, North Korea.
We don't have time. This is exactly the best time, actually, in fact, for foreign adversaries to take advantage of the chaos, not just because of coronavirus, but, you know, the markets. The markets are reacting to what's happening.
On the North Korea matter, it probably is. Coronavirus there is apparently at a even scarier level than it is in Iran.
Of course. It's
probably going to be for them a civilization. Like, for them, it could be the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's going to be, the problem is, like, our response right now is not meaningfully, the U.S.'s response is not meaningfully different from the countries who are failing to respond at all. Like, yes. There's no sign that we've done anything to blunt the effects.
Yes.
And we're just not ready.
Yeah, there's just no information coming out of, like, you know, some countries that they're, I mean, Russia, same, Iran, the same.
And here's the thing, this virus can be handled by a proper government reaction. Look at, well, South Korea especially. Look at Hong Kong. My God, if Hong Kong can they have like 2 deaths. If they can do it, there's no excuse for any other government in the world because it's so they crowded. Have the worst conditions. In
so
terms of, like,
crowded.
Yeah. So if they can do it, we should have been able to do it. Yeah. And yet we're not.
Yeah. This is going to come down to state and local governments. So, you know, I mean, and I think the response of state and local governments is pretty good. Do they have the resources and the backing of the, and I think that's what's happening. Like, for example, Larry Hogan, you know, announced a state of emergency in Maryland when there were about like 3 casualties, which it doesn't seem like it's a state of emergency, but it does allow states to tap into all kinds of resources. And that's the way they're going to have to do it.
I mean, state and local governments are going to have to respond to the immediate emergencies and overwhelming medical demands, but you cannot have an effective response based just on local and state responders.
I mean, this, and the burden will be on state and local responders because I saw, you know, a thread that, you know, what's really going to end up happening is that hospitals will get overwhelmed. We have the capacity in our ERs in the United States for 100. We have 100,000 ER beds in the United States. They're predicting we're going to need at least twice that, 2 to 3 times that, when this kind of peaks. And in Italy right now, and Italy, the entire country has been shut down. They're saying this is the biggest problem, is that they are overwhelmed with patients in hospitals. They do not have beds. The doctors and nurses are exhausted. They don't have supplies. That's where everything comes to a head.
So here's where Italy is at now. They are issuing statements that say, quote, "It may become necessary to establish an age limit for access to intensive care."
Wow. Mm-hmm. Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yep.
So people over a certain age are just not going to get the care?
They're just going to let them die.
That is horrifying.
And it's not like that. That may be the responsible call. Like if the reality of it is that.
Wow.
It's triage. It's like a earthquake or
and
something.
And we're talking about a matter of weeks. I mean, this happened like in a matter, like a month ago, they had 400 cases.
Italy is about what, 11 or 10 days ahead of us on the infection curve? We're going to be at those levels in like 11 days.
Shit, man.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm scared.
I mean, don't be like,
I'm not scared for, I feel
not
like.
Not that I'm not scared, but like.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be bad. Like it's going to be.
Prepare for the worst. Hope for the best. How's that? Fair enough?
Just make sure everyone's preparing.
Yeah.
At least, kids, I mean, the one bright spot in all this is that, like, I mean, kids are hardy little fuckers and aren't being taken down by
kids are doing well, unless they already have, like, you know, some kind of illness. But yeah, thank God for that. I that would have been terrifying if this had like an adverse, like a really serious effect on kids. All right. So as this is happening, the markets are reeling. And over the weekend, like oil just dropped and dropped and dropped. And so apparently what's happening is starting, I think it was March 7th is when this began, just a few days ago, that OPEC Plus, which is, you know, the nations that produce oil and export oil, and includes Plus is like your Russia and a couple other countries, they had a meeting and, you know, they Russia was like, well, listen, the plan was to keep production low, you know, stabilize the cost of oil, as you know, in relation to the supply and all demand, all that stuff. And Russia walks in and is like, nobody expected this apparently, and they're like, we're not going to do it. We're not cutting production. We have decided to actually continue, and they came into this meeting having made the decision that this was the opportunity This was the right opportunity to squeeze the American market, because right now the United States is the largest oil producer in the world, and a lot of it's due to fracking, which has added millions of barrels of oil to the global markets. The U.S. shale industry has been booming. So Russia's like, we're not going to cut back. We're going to squeeze American markets. We're going to continue to like flood global supply with oil. And Saudi, and apparently for hours they tried, and they're like, nope, that was the end of it. At the end of the day, they're like, we're not doing it. So apparently Russia has been really pissed off with the Trump administration in the last couple of years, that for a couple of reasons. Number one, that the U.S. has like sanctions against like completing a pipeline that's connecting Siberia's gas fields with Germany. It's called Nord Stream 2. And also the White House, we also know that, you know, Trump's been targeting Venezuelan business of Russia's state oil producer Rosneft. And so this is really, I guess, hurting them. And it's 40%, like oil production is 40% of the Russian economy. So they're like, we're going to do it. And so Saudi Arabia is like, well, oh, hell no. We're going to do the same thing then. And so that's where we are. And so oil prices are plummeting. And our president, ever the optimist, said, this is great. It's great for the consumer. Good for the consumer. But it's really, really bad for the United States economy.
It's bad for the world economy. I mean, it's basically Russia and Saudi Arabia are trying to see who's the bigger, badder oil producer and who can withstand the most pain. But it comes at a very inopportune time.
Yeah. Well, Saudi's going to hurt the most from this probably because, I mean, it's their oil is 70% of their income.
Yeah, but they're gambling that they can outlast the Russians.
And the United States.
Well, yeah. But it's really who's going to cry uncle first between the two of them.
Yeah. And so when this happened over the weekend, then I saw like all kinds of shit happening with, like on Monday morning, the Dow didn't open, right? Like there were like zero trading on Monday morning. What was that? I've never even heard of that.
It dropped too far and they had an emergency stop to try and let people calm down and come back to the trading floor a little bit less panicked.
So what is happening right now?
Well, I mean, it's definitely partially, or in large part, in response to the coronavirus pandemic. But the markets, as of like 12 minutes ago, just entered into the bear market territory, 20% down from its recent highs. And the market cannot figure out what it wants to do. Like, if you had, over the past like week and a half, if you had a strategy of like, what, like alternate days of buying everything mm-hmm. and shorting everything, you'd be like a billionaire because right. the market's reliably on up 1,000 points, down 1,000, up 1,000, down 1,000.
Right.
As it tries to figure out what's going to happen, how the government's going to respond, how big of a problem this is. And even aside from like, even if we could have avoided a mass spread in the United States of COVID-19, the markets were already impacted unavoidably because they had, you know, the whole month almost of the Chinese markets not operating, not producing, not shipping. So we are going to be impacted regardless. And now we're dealing with that plus the U.S.'s own pain that's going to be coming down the pipeline. So there's all that. And then, but there's also like a lot of reason to think that the markets were already independently, totally unrelated to any kind of pandemic nonsense, in a shaky place. And that things might have been not as rosy as they seemed, even aside from this extra stress.
Yes, because you taught us all about that inverse yield thing.
Well, it's not like, obviously it's not clockwork, but in this case it seemed to be like clockwork because it's actually working pretty much on the dot. but it's more like there were definitely signs for the past 17 months that things, that trouble was on the horizon.
Yeah.
This is not a shock. Like people, no one ever like expects the recession when it comes, but at the same time when you look back you're like, oh yep, all those signs were totally there.
Okay, so Trump did announce on Monday that apparently he had a phone call with MBS, then he announced on Monday that he's gonna try to help out U.S. shale producers. He's also announced that they're thinking about like some kind of bailouts for all the other industries impacted by coronavirus. I mean, left and right, you've got conferences being canceled, travel being canceled. Expedia just laid off 3,000 people. My husband who works in consulting, a lot of consultants that work anywhere related to a travel or leisure industry laid off. So this is having really, I mean, like it's just starting. Like the snowball is just starting.
The energy bailouts are absurd because guess what? you know, oil is not going to be impacted by coronavirus. It's still going to be there once it's all over. Yeah. Like, it's not going to be the kind of thing you need a bailout for. But
it's
Trump
not
is,
a commodity, yeah.
But Trump is more concerned about just his reelection. That's really how he's doing all of this. So he wants to try and, you know, gin up the economy any way he can. And then there's possible response of bailing out or whatever they want to call it. The possible response of stimulus to various, like, travel-related industries. It makes sense to a certain degree. The fact that cruise lines are on there is absurd. That's just a nonsense joke.
Why do you think that's absurd?
Because cruise lines, like, one, are making things worse. We don't need to boost them up. Two, guess what? Those are foreign flag ships. Like, it's not really American. Like, that money's not going to be boosting American economic interest.
Right.
But on the other hand, the travel industry and the hotel industry, like, it's not really the companies that are the concern so much. It's their employees. And trying to keep them in their jobs is a genuine concern that's worthy of addressing in some manner. Trump is also, I think it's already within 24 hours, it's already been dismissed and killed as an idea. But he was hoping for a tax cut on payroll taxes.
Right.
Across, like, basically the complete tax rollback of payroll taxes. And he wanted
until the election, right? Until the election.
End of the year. So it lasts into the election.
Yeah.
Now, in the briefing where this came up, I think it was John Roberts, because no one else let us questions that entire briefing. He was like, okay, but how are you possibly, like, going to make that up? Like, that's like over $1 trillion we're just, like, casually tossing out the window. And the only response was like, well, the economy is very strong and we'll find a way to make it up. And, like, just nonsense.
It's just about his votes. It's just about the election.
Yeah, but, like, even Republicans weren't going for that because it is just nonsense. Like, none of these were realistic ideas that could be employed in any kind of way.
So, I read that the IRS is, have they already done it, or they're thinking about it, pushing tax filing date, the deadline?
I mean, I guess that makes sense, but, like, I mean, we're now in a situation where, in order to respond to this pandemic, American citizens, American government officials, they're not just trying to respond to the pandemic. They have to also do so while not pissing off the leader.
Right.
They have to find a way to carefully address a pandemic situation without accidentally hurting the feelings of the man in charge. And it's true that, like Dr. Fauci has this task before him every day. I think he's going to fail it because there's no one who's ever succeeded to do this kind of, you know, sell your dignity to remain in the administration successfully. I think he's going to trade his credibility away for this. But he, in his mind, like, we want him there. He's one of the few people on the team that is actually capable of doing this and has experience necessary, but he cannot do his job if he upsets Trump. So he has to walk the line.
I mean, I feel like, so I, unless I missed something, I don't think I've seen him give any public statements since last week, which is when, like, he said some contradictory things to Trump. I would be okay with him doing the work behind the scenes if it means
we don't need behind the scenes is not where he'd be any good. Where he needs to be is the voice of reason. Because no one else is doing it. He's the one who today at the hearing was like, he was asked, like, is this going to get worse? He's like, yes, it is going to get worse. He used the word millions when talking about, like, the people who would be, like, severely impacted or killed. He's the only one in the administration who is doing anything like that. So we need to have some voice of mild truth. And mild truth is all he can do right now.
Yeah. Another impact, actually, that just occurred to me is the fact that many, many universities now are closing their campuses and saying students have to pack up the shit and leave. If they're living on campus, we're going to be doing stuff online. And that's not easy for a lot of students. Students who have paid for meal plans, who might not have anywhere to go, might not have money to travel, international. I mean,
I mean, and also the coronavirus disinformation campaigns coming from Russia, apparently. Like,
is it what? What?
Yeah, Russia apparently is behind, like, various, like, social media accounts spreading misinformation about coronavirus.
Well,
like,
Fox isn't helping.
Y'all realize, though, like, this is not, like, going to be, like, a U.S. chaos thing. Like, y'all going to suffer from this, too.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, well, I will say Tucker Carlson apparently was somebody who, I mean, of all people on Fox, actually shot straight and said, this is what's happening. And
straight-ish.
It-ish. I mean, it wasn't at least, like, the other kind of, you know, message that this is all a hoax and it's just to bring down the president. But he's like, no, this needs to be taken seriously. But speaking of Russia, so Russia continues to get a pass, although it's interesting, it'll be interesting to watch what happens between on the oil front with Putin and Trump, because that's one thing Putin's not happy about, I guess, with Trump. But so there was a, yesterday there was a briefing on the Hill, an intelligence briefing. And we, you might remember ODNI, the head of ODNI was replaced, what, a couple of weeks ago or a month ago or so?
With Rick Grenell, Jesus Christ, yeah, Twitter troll.
Right. And that happened right after Congress was briefed and told that Russia is has a preference of Trump over other presidential candidates. And Trump was really upset that that was told in a briefing. And so he replaced him. Now, when they had this briefing yesterday, William Avenina, who is now the head of National Counterintelligence, yesterday he appeared to kind of temper that assessment. And he said, look, he said that Russians, quote, continue to be broadly engaged in social media activities designed to divide us further, to discredit our electoral system, and to disrupt our election. However, apparently there's not necessarily a preference thing that they could point to.
But also, like, also 2 weeks ago, they had the story that was leaked almost certainly by Grenell about how the Russians were have a preference for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary.
Oh, and so Trump just tweeted that. Like, he's been tweeting that nonstop.
And now suddenly the intelligence are like telling Congress, oh, and you know what? They're just trying to cause chaos. They ain't got a preference for who wins in the end as long as they cause maximum chaos. And this is where the politicization of the intel is, I mean, it's paralyzing because, you know, the policymakers, the people on the Hill, they don't want to disbelieve the intel agencies. They have to rely on them. But at the same time, this is hard to reconcile with what you can see for yourself, what happened in 2016 when the report and conclusion was very firm that there was a preference for Trump over Hillary Clinton. And also this, well, just 2 weeks ago, there's apparently a reporting that DNI has concluded that Putin does favor Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary. So how can they be so sure and tell Congress now that Russia, despite all evidence and all obvious inferences, doesn't really care if Trump wins or not?
Well, Grenell didn't show up to answer that question. So
yeah, at least he recognized the limitations.
Yeah. Whatever this interference looks like for, I feel like it's kind of completely out of the hands of anybody at this point. It just seems like it's, although, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in November, because I feel like there, on one hand, there is a possibility that given what's happening with the coronavirus, what if Trump calls like a national state of emergency as elections are off, or that there has been interference to the extent that we cannot trust the results of this election. Interestingly, Biden had they had a series of town halls, I think, last week, and Biden was asked this question by somebody: what will you do if Trump loses, but he won't, like, you know, leave the office? And Biden said, "Look, I think Trump has mistreated the intelligence agencies and mistreated law enforcement, military, and there will be plenty of people who will escort him right out." So,
who? That, like, half the positions are of like civilian control over DOD are empty, and the rest are filled by total lackeys.
Yeah,
I think it's in, like, there's not a chance in the world that Trump will leave quietly, and whatever happens, he will have a way to say, "Oh, the results aren't correct,
legitimate."
He will. I mean, even if he wins, he's going to say that. It's like 100% Trump is going to say the election was illegitimate in some way, in his favor of him, whether or not he, like, truly won or not, which is part of the problem, because if his response, I mean, you can't say that he really lost and he's just complaining, because you know that even if he won, he probably would still complain.
He would complain and be like, my numbers were higher than they're reporting.
Yeah. So it's scary. And I think that the fact that he controls the intel agencies means that we have no real way of preparing for it.
I think what's incredibly frustrating is that Facebook is just allowing these Russian or whatever foreign interests, I mean, to continue to put out misinformation. And I'm sure it's not just foreign. I'm sure there are plenty of domestic entities, including those tied to candidates, that are putting out all kinds of false and misleading information. I mean, just last week, there was a series of videos that came out that was, I think, even retweeted by Trump or Trump Jr., I can't remember, that were just that were cut to show Biden, like, endorsing Trump. And I mean, literally, they're like manipulating and changing videos and putting them out there. It's shocking, because a lot of people are going to look at that and believe it. All right. Now, we talked a little bit about the peace plan with the Taliban. I wanted to, like, follow up what happened. We talked about the last week. It's not a big news item.
It didn't work out? You're telling me that...
Well, Susan, really? we don't really know. You know why? Because this, let me tell you what the messaging is like, all right? On one hand, there was a House Armed Forces Committee hearing the other day. And at that hearing, Marine General Frank McKenzie said that, look, I know we're supposed to cut the number of... We're supposed to have full withdrawal within 14 months, but there's no actual plans for it. He also said that CENTCOM, or actually Bolton, Michael, Ambassador Bolton, he tweeted, this is what he tweeted, this is what he said. He said, CENTCOM clear has no confidence that the Taliban will honor the recent deal. The current escalation in violence is evidence they're not really pursuing peace. This remains an unacceptable risk of terrorism, again, emanating from Afghanistan. And then he linked to the story about this House Armed Services Committee meeting. And at that briefing, McKenzie said that right now the Taliban attacks are continue to be a lot higher than what are... So this was weird to me, that there is like a certain amount that are allowed in the peace plan, a certain limit of violence that's acceptable in the peace plan. But right now it's we're on the...
It's a semi-peace plan.
It's a semi-peace plan. We're in the... the Taliban has exceeded those limits. So McKenzie said he has no confidence the group will honor its commitments. At the same time... The Pentagon spokesman, Jonathan Hoffman, said that actually Secretary Mark Esper says that the U.S.-Taliban deal is holding up. And he said, while levels are not as low as some would like them to be, we've seen progress and we hope that continues to hold. So on, you have these competing messages. What's happening in Afghanistan is also batshit crazy because Ashraf Ghani is the president, and that is the administration that the United States is dealing with and trying to bring Taliban to the table with them and propose a peace deal between those two parties. However, on Monday, both Ghani and his political rival, whose name is Abdullah Abdullah, were both sworn in as president in separate ceremonies. That actually happened.
Hey, it happened in Georgia once.
Oh, did it really?
Yeah.
Tell me that story.
Well, we had, you know, governor that didn't want to go, and, you know, we just kind of... It worked it out. What? It's fine. It worked it out in the end. It's cool. It all ended well.
I might have to look that up because we might have a similar situation in the White House soon. But then Trump says, apparently, I think today, or he says that, okay, look, shit is going down in flames. However, and he said, Trump said the Taliban could possibly overrun the Afghani government after the U.S. troops withdraw, but, quote, countries have to take care of themselves. You can only hold someone's hand for so long. Asked if the Taliban could eventually seize power, Trump said, it's not supposed to happen that way, but it possibly will.
Really, really reassuring.
Mission accomplished. All right. So that's what's happening with the peace plan. There's no peace plan. What is this Jeff Sessions thing that you popped in here? What's going on with Sessions?
Look, we need some happiness and some levity in the, okay, amid all this chaos. And my favorite... You know, the thing that cheered me up most this week was this tweet from Jeff Sessions.
Oh, God, this is so sad. I'm just reading this
it's
now.
It's so sad.
Oh, Jeff. I mean, the man, he literally shits on you publicly.
Oh, it's like, I mean, couldn't happen to a better guy. Anyway, so Jeff Sessions had his primary in Alabama for his old Senate seat. He's trying to get back. And
he lost.
He didn't lose, but he didn't win.
Okay.
So there'll be a runoff.
Oh, there'll be a runoff. Okay.
And after it happened, apparently Trump had been like, apparently the White House managed to convince Trump not to tweet about Sessions after it was over. And his reward for doing so was that after the election was over, he was able to like tweet about how much Jeff Sessions sucks.
He did mean tweet Jeff Sessions, yes.
For no reason. Like basically it was like a cookie. Like if you can avoid saying anything before the election, you can trash him after. So he did. And now Sessions is tweeting out this. I'm one of the architects of the Trump agenda. I have always supported it and always will. Nothing the president can do will deter me from supporting this agenda. Because my principles, just like my faith, are fundamental to who I am and unmovable.
Oh my God.
We are Alabama. Nobody tells us how to vote or what to do. So basically, Jeff Sessions is saying that even though the president is shitting all over me on Twitter,
I got it.
I'm going to still totally embrace and support the Trump agenda, but not because I'm a little like reek lackey, but because I want to from the bottom of my heart.
What do you think he's trying to do here? Oh, I know what he's doing. He's appealing to Trump's base, right? That's what he's trying to do.
He's trying to thread the needle of appealing to Trump's base while Trump is openly mocking him and insulting him. And he's trying to like maintain like some kind of like dignity and credibility. He's like, oh, I'm not doing this because I'm like pathetic. I'm doing it because I'm so truly committed that even the president making fun of me for doing it isn't going to stop me.
So Sessions.
Like, he's trying to explain why he's still subservient to Trump when Trump's done all this to him.
Oh my God, that's so humiliating. No shame, no dignity. Just self-quarantine for the rest of your life, Jeff Sessions. That's my advice there.
And guess what? He was still the best attorney general that Trump picked.
Excellent. Oh, what's going on with Barr? Anything we need to know?
More of the same shenanigans. And guess what? We have no time to deal with all the stuff he was pulling because pandemic.
Let me ask you this. Now that Mulvaney is out...
Mulvaney's gone. Not gone yet, but he'll be gone. But right.
Mark Meadows is in. Now that Mulvaney is about to be gone, because we know Trump's been unhappy with him for a little bit, do you think that that might encourage him to appear, like respond to a subpoena? No.
Oh, no. Hmm. He wants to have a lucrative post-public life career, and that would get in the way.
Yeah.
Also, the Democrats have apparently given up on any kind of oversight whatsoever. They never tried to call Bolton. They never tried to do jack shit. They have just totally given up on the idea of anything and doing with calling out Trump's corruption. They're over it. They did that, tried that so much. They're done.
It was a lot. I mean, it was a lot of time.
It was a lot of time, and they didn't see results. So the point is, you're not doing it to win. You're doing it to save the country.
Because it's the right thing to do. Yeah. Well, speaking of saving the country, it looks like Biden's the front runner. It looks like it's going to be Biden and Trump in November.
Ugh, I don't even care anymore. I don't care. I just don't care. But if you never prefer anyone, you can't be disappointed. And yet I still am.
I mean, he wasn't my first, second, third, or fourth choice, or maybe even fifth. Anyhow, but it is what it is. I mean, it's interesting that people are turning out in droves for Biden. I think the best analysis I've seen of why this is happening is that he seems to be the most, the most tried and tested. Seems to bring a sense of stability. He's tied to Obama. It's just people feel more comfortable there. They're like, we're just not ready for a counter-revolution, basically, to Trump, because
people want some boring-ass bullshit. That's what they're craving in their soul of souls right now.
They just want somebody to steady the ship. And you know what? I get that. And I have, the truth is, our primary is so far down the road that it kind of doesn't matter anymore. I think by the end of April, in a week, it'll be done one person, right? I mean, so it won't matter what my preference is, but whoever it is, I'll put my full support behind them. Muslims for Bernie, Muslims for whatever, Biden, I don't care, whatever. My heart broke when Warren dropped out anyways. I'm so sad. All right. Is that it for us this week?
Well, let's make it enough because...
Yeah. All right. Well, Susan, stay safe. Enjoy your quarantine. We are all going to get, if we're lucky, we'll all get fat and caught up on our Netflix queue in the next few weeks. But, be careful, folks. Take care of yourselves.
And talk to your older relatives. Tell them to stop watching Fox. Yes. And take it seriously.
Stay home. Be careful. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back in 7 days.
See you then.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.